Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, March 19th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, from the Benjamin Dixon Show, Ben Dixon himself will be joining us. And then later, Paul Blessed, writer, Discourse, will be with us. Meanwhile, U.S. reaches Biden's 100 million vaccination in 100 days, 42 days early. But as COVID starts to regain momentum, is that going to be fast enough? The U.S. agrees to send 4 million doses of AstraZeneca shots to Canada and Mexico. The FBI is now investigating Cuomo's shady push for nursing home and hospital liability protection. This and more allegations of staff mistreatment by him. Washington, the Senate confirms Javier Becerra, Secretary of Health and Human Services. The House passes a bill to provide Dreamers and those with temporary protected status a path to citizenship. Representative Pat Toomey blocks a Senate bill to protect COVID relief checks from creditors. Drug makers promise investors they will hike COVID-19 vaccine prices. And why are liberal think tanks pushing resumption of student loan payments by September? 50-plus House Democrats call for Joe Biden to fire the entire Postal Board of Governors. Replace him with people who will then fire Louis DeJoy. HUD reports massive growth of homelessness, devastating even pre-pandemic. Governor Northam taking executive action to enfranchise former felons, giving 70,000 people in Virginia the right to vote. All this and more on today's program. That's a big deal in Virginia. And of course, also, I should mention, joining me as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma. How are you?
I am well. Happy Friday, Sam.
Thank you very much. In fact, it's also almost happy spring, right? Tomorrow's the, they call it, is tomorrow the equinox?
I don't keep track of these arbitrary deadlines. It's more That's... when things start to consistently be warm or warm-ish, then it's spring.
It's specifically, the equinox is specifically not an arbitrary deadline. It's the
It's arbitrary to my life, so the world revolves around me. It's just like, that's the point.
Well, Brendan, Matt, will you chime in? Like, what is tomorrow the equinox?
I'm
right. This is we're not a science-based program. That's basically what comes
Saturday.
Saturday. Something's happened tomorrow, and it has something to do with the planets.
5:37 a.m. spring equinox, in the northern hemisphere.
Right, spring equinox in the northern hemisphere. I'm not even sure we know what that means around here.
Sun is coming up to the northern hemisphere. I know that much.
That's what it is.
And, we're moving closer to the sun.
Basically, what it's going to mean is that the sun is going to be a little more intense. It's going to be a little higher in the sky, and we're all going to feel better.
So that is the definition of not being arbitrary.
I mean, it is specifically not arbitrary.
It's right.
Not,
okay. It's, well, you know, you live and you learn.
Yep. There you go. Well, that's what we're here for. To give, you know, almost accurate information about some basic science that you would learn in, like, I don't know, fourth grade or something like that.
Okay, Copernicus.
Accurate, but yeah. Not precise.
Exactly. We don't need to be too, listen, nobody needs to be. And the other thing that we teach is a certain amount of humility about those things. Because you want to go around, people think you're an egghead. So there you go.
An egghead.
Right. There you go. It's Casual Friday, folks. You will notice I am wearing a soft collared shirt, which is why we're taking this type of attitude today. There are some days where you just have a bunch of tiny stories that, I feel compelled to share with people, but, I couldn't even fit them on my whole list of, headlines. One is that Martin Heinrich, he is a Democratic senator from New Mexico. He was previously one of those people who, were sort of somewhat vocal about preserving the filibuster. On Thursday, he came out and said that the filibuster's got to go, at least in some form. And he said, quote, too often the filibuster has been used to block our country's continued march toward equality. We must change this. Again, a good sign. You know, Joe Manchin's all over the place. He is for some change, but not other change. We'll see. We'll see where he is. I mean, so much of what Joe Manchin is about is literally just placing a couple stories in there showing that he's being difficult, and then he comes around. We'll talk more about that with Ben Dixon. This one, I don't even know how to respond to this. This is ludicrous. Apparently dozens of young, and this is from the Daily Beast, of White House staffers have been suspended, asked to resign, or placed in a remote work program due to past marijuana use. Apparently, they were told initially from the Biden administration that recreational use of cannabis would not immediately disqualify would-be personnel, and sort of the Biden administration backtrack. I mean, for security clearances, this is absurd. And in 5 years, in the next administration, it's not even going to be a question. I mean, we're going to have legalization across the country, and the idea that this is a security risk is absurd.
I mean, it's probably just them like adhering to old arcane laws. I mean, I remember growing up when my mom suspected that maybe I was partaking, she would say, well, you can't work at the federal government if you do that. Apparently that's a thing, but it's bizarre. It's pretty absurd to be enforcing that in this current day and age, like, it's especially because apparently one of the people that he let go had been at the White House for 5 years or something like that, or had been working for the government for 5 years.
Well, obviously it's
his running mate.
I mean, I don't know. The only thing I take from that is that is one of the strangest things I can imagine a parent saying to their kid is why they shouldn't smoke pot. It's like, you won't be able to get a federal agency job.
Well, this was when I thought I was going to maybe be a lawyer. And I had not, you know, I was like, I'm a teenager. I thought I might be a lawyer, might work for the government. That was my idea.
All right. Fair enough.
Well, I've changed my tune since then. Clearly.
Yeah, I guess so.
Now I'm here with you.
There you go. And well, we'll be incidentally, we'll have our monthly drug tests. We'll be coming up in just a week, but we'll talk about that at the commissary meeting.
Oh no.
I feel like that's a cautionary tale.
Yeah. China and the U.S. Open a meeting, an Alaska meeting, and apparently it was started off with a chilly start. I mean, there is a lot of grandstanding with China, but at least there's, you know, they're sitting down talking to them. Marcy Wheeler over at the Empty Wheel reminds us that the Durham investigation, this is the investigation to investigate the investigators, has now lasted longer than the Mueller investigation did. It is the 675th day of the Durham investigation into the origins and conduct of the investigation that became the Mueller investigation. And so Durham's investigation has actually lasted longer, one day longer, than the entire investigation that he was investigating. He could have spent one day investigating each day of the Mueller investigation, and he'd still, but now he's a day over. Joe Biden apparently is weighing keeping U.S. troops in Afghanistan to November. You'll remember that the Trump administration made a deal to pull out, to pull out his troops or by U.S. troops by May 1st. And that was an agreement negotiated with the Taliban. Apparently, Biden has pushed back against the Defense Department's efforts to keep the troops in Afghanistan beyond May 1. But he is contemplating a 6-month extension because, you know, we're always 6 months out. In fact, I think it was Atreus who referred to that as an FU, a Freedman unit. 6 months. And the Biden administration, some good news, have been quietly, according to Politico, revoking the previous administration's waivers and approvals of Medicaid work rules in two states. Arkansas and New Hampshire had applied for a waiver to Medicaid rules to allow for them to impose work requirements on Medicaid in those two states. And the Biden administration is saying, not so fast. We're not going to do that. It's absurd. One of the primary reasons why you would need Medicaid is either you don't have a job or your job doesn't even pay enough to pay for insurance. But that's good for the Biden administration. And after 4 years under Trump, the words climate and science are now allowed to be back on the EPA website. So you no longer have to go to the Environmental Protection Agency and say,
wow.
Like, how come they're not mentioning the word science or climate? So there you go. David Dayan is reporting that the CDC has extended the eviction moratorium. It was scheduled to end at the end of this month, March 31st. We are not clear yet at this point how much longer it will be past March 31st. I cannot think of a crueler, more unnecessarily harsh and callous way of doing this, where people have this measure of anxiety up until 2 weeks before they think they might be evicted. The bottom line is the U.S. government should be standing up. And if they got to pay the landlords, pay the landlords. But and I know there was some relief in this past bill that passed. My understanding is that it's considered inadequate by maybe two or three times. But just this dynamic of people who have been hurting and are worried about whether they're going to be thrown out of their homes. It's just absurd. And speaking of absurd, let's play this clip from The Five yesterday. This was this crossed our path, and it was that ridiculous. Here's Greg Gutfeld, and he's got Matt, how did you characterize this? Or what is it, Brendan, how did you characterize it? Like some way of owning the libs or something. I can't remember what it was, but here's
one strange trick.
Yeah, exactly. Own the libs with this one strange trick. Greg Gutfeld has figured it out.
My view, there's a really, really big story going on regarding immigration. But it's going on outside of this show right now. If you turn on any other channel, viewers are being sold the idea that America is the land of white supremacy. Yet right now we are seeing thousands, tens of thousands, and it will be millions of non-white people risking life and limb to come to America. Why would they do that if they believed what they saw on CNN, that we are a nation of racists? Why are they coming? Because they know that it's not true. They are actually literally voting with their feet, which is destroying the big lie about what this country is, the big lie that's being sold to Americans by CNN and other media outlets. America, they believe, is the land of opportunity, not the land of white racism. And that is tearing a massive hole in the white power narrative that is being played 24/7. The bottom line about immigration, a country has to be able to dictate its borders. That's obvious. Other countries can't dictate your border by having large numbers of people go to it. Yet we have to control it. They have to control theirs. But I want the people to come here that want to be here with me. That makes me feel good. It makes me feel good because they're validating our country. They're validating our values. And they crush the central fallacy of woke identity politics, that this country is forever stained with white supremacy.
Cool, because give them all citizenship.
That we're seeing right now on the border who blast that idea all to hell. And that should make everybody happy. And it's why other networks aren't covering this story, because it destroys all the other stories they're doing.
Well,
my favorite part of that was when he said, it makes me feel good. It should make you feel good. Makes me feel validated. You know, when you go to therapy, you learn that validation is something that sometimes your therapist needs to do to you to just kind of get you to a certain point. But once you gain some iota of self-understanding, you don't constantly need validation in order to go about your daily life and have a view about yourself and the people that surround you. But conservatives and people insecure in their worldview and constantly scared, people like Greg Gutfeld, need to see politics in the lens of validating their Homerism about the United States. And so that's how he twisted all those things around and got to this point.
Yeah, I mean, he spent last night at 3 a.m. writing out a soliloquy that proved to him that there's no white supremacy in the country. I mean, first off, the idea that he had to write all this out, I found quite impressive. Like, this is, he figured out this trick and it's so intricate.
It's like that meme of the math problems going across Zach Galifianakis's face.
Right. There's no way, I guess, according to Greg Gutfeld, that non-white people would try to immigrate to this country if we were white supremacists. Now, there was immigration during slavery, but according to Greg Gutfeld, that was not an era of white supremacy, right? Because the two things can't exist at the same time. You can't have immigrants coming who are not white. And we should also add, that time, you know, Italians weren't even considered white in the construct that they are today. But there was people coming from China. There were people coming from all over the world. To this country. But if, according to Greg Gutfeld's calculations, his formula that he's discovered that nobody will report because it will destroy everything that everyone else is talking about, even during slavery, that we were not a white supremacist country. And then the other thing is embedded, what's fascinating to me is, why are they, he acknowledges they're risking life and limb. Now let's just break that down for a moment. Why is this a risk? It's either because they're coming from areas where it's so dangerous that their lives are on the line. Many of these people are coming from some of the most violent places in the world. Or we have made it so hard for them to immigrate to this country that they're risking their lives in the process of doing it. And if we were not a white supremacist country, we would make sure that those people are not risking their lives to try and immigrate here. We would be far, far, even if we were going to have a harsh, restrictive immigration policy, we would make sure that we were not putting them in kids in cages, or we would have proper facilities. We would not be putting them in prisons. I mean, his whole premise that they are risking their lives is an indication of our white supremacy.
It's also good to know that they're not just coming for the welfare, but to work hard. And also, if you look at the ruling class of any Central or South American country, pretty white also, especially compared to the rest of the population. A lot of people that have to make these journeys are indigenous themselves. So white supremacy is very much active in those other places. It's just that materially they've been forced, or for whatever reason, for safety, they have to move.
Matt, are you telling me that colonialism is white supremacy?
Yeah, in fact, those are also European settler colonial nations. So
wow.
Because they're not as lily white as the ruling class Brian Kilmeade is comfortable with.
And I would also just add, like, but with all that said, Greg should spend the next part of his show talking about why none of those Republicans voted to provide a path of citizenship to the Dreamers or to those folks who are here on temporary protected status, and why the Republican Party is so virulently anti-immigrant. I mean, that's the story that they're not telling on Fox, is if that the people is that, you know, you could destroy. I mean, if Greg's right, he can shatter the entire consciousness of this country by promoting immigration amongst the Republican Party.
If they're coming here to experience the spirit of the anti-racist utopian America, why not reward them? Greg Gutfeld, no, just wants to slam the door in their face. There's like, that's the logical hurdle that he has yet to climb. But I wish him the best of luck in that effort.
And lastly, let's talk about what the big lie is. Matt, will you tell people where that phrase coined from?
Nazi Germany, I believe, a big lie. I can't remember the exact case study was, but one of basically, if you tell a lie big enough, I don't have a history on this as well as I should. But
the idea that the big lie is, in fact, that there's white supremacy in this country, and it's debunked by the fact that people who are trying to immigrate here have to risk life and limb is just absurd. It's absurd. And in fact, also, you know, I mean, if that was the case, why is Greg Gutfeld even living in New York? Right. I mean, if there is no, if you don't like the ideology of a place, and that's the, you know, and that is enough for you to leave, why is Greg Gutfeld in New York?
Yeah.
Why blaming is Jews Dave for in Florida? I mean, well, I mean, in California, like, I mean, give me a break.
Yeah. Blaming Jews for Germany losing World War One is an example of a big lie. So.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ben Dixon will be joining us. Folks, today's episode is sponsored by Sunset Lake CBD. You can get their products at sunsetlakecbd.com. These are my favorite sponsors. This is a product that I use more or less on a daily basis, but different variants of it. I use their Solve. CBD Solve that comes with that's mixed in with arnica and beeswax, and I use that for sore muscles and for skin stuff. I'll take the tincture to help me to go to sleep occasionally, as like a, maybe sometimes an end to an evening. I'll have a pre-roll, and I try now to not indulge too much in the CBD fudge. Because that's more of a sweet tooth issue for me, but they have they have CBD gummies, they have all sorts of smokables. Matt, speak about the smalls.
Yeah, the smalls are these pre-stemmed buds that come packaged, so you can slip them right into your grinder among anything else you might be grinding up, and adds a nice little CBD kick.
They have, they have. Coffee that's infused with CBD. They're fantastic products. They're a great company. $15 minimum wage for everybody who works there, minimum. And they are a mostly employee-owned company. Their farm provides dairy for Ben and Jerry's ice cream. They're outside of Burlington, Vermont. They do stuff for the community there. They've had different initiatives over the course of the year. And they practice regenerative farming practices in conjunction with working with the University of Vermont. 100% pesticide free. They use integrated pest management to keep the bugs off their crop. They're 100% organic fertilizer, just great all around. And it's a really effective product. It is, if you've ever, you know, it's just a great way to calm yourself. Frankly, and it has helped me in various situations, and they're fans of the show. And so Left is Best is their coupon code. Left is Best, 20% off. Check it out. SunsetLakeCBD.com. Left is Best for the coupon code. You will not be disappointed. All right. We got Ben. Great. Joining us now, the proprietor of the Benjamin Dixon Show. Also, he's got a lot of other programs that he's got going.
There we go.
On his end. Ben Dixon, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. It's always a pleasure. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. I'm here with Emma. And Ben, what are the other shows that you got going on? What do you got?
I don't have my light on here.
No, you look pretty good.
We do the morning show, Like It or Not, and that's the morning show. We have our DJ and our co-host, and we just try to make try to not make people too angry about politics before they go to work.
There you go. That's helpful.
It always worked.
Exactly. Well, I mean, right now, you know, let me ask you this, because we're in the wake of the $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill, and this past week, Joe Biden came out and signaled, if not some flexibility on the filibuster, you know, some indication that there needs to be filibuster reform. Yeah. And I think let's just work under the premise that if they're going to reform the filibuster, they're going to make it so that they can pass legislation at times. Right. I mean, it's not going to be one of these reforms that are like ultimately Mitch McConnell's going to be able to work around and there's going to be some loophole and he's going to be able to prohibit things. Where are we as someone? And I know that you were and I was. As intense skeptics of Joe Biden, nobody that we're talking, we're supportive of him in the primary, certainly, but obviously wanted him to beat Donald Trump. Where is he in terms of meeting those expectations?
In terms of the filibuster, I mean, it was good to hear him signal that he was open to reform. But I think like most of our suspicions are probably accurate that he would rather find a way to get a couple of pieces of legislation into law without having to nuke the entire filibuster, because then they really wouldn't have any excuse to go full throttle on some progressive legislation that actually helps working people. That said, how is he going to pull it off? I'm not really sure, but there's a lot of pressure because the first bill, the HR1, you know, we're trying to get that passed in the Senate, and that's a major piece of legislation that if they're not willing to get rid of the filibuster in order to get that piece of legislation passed, they're going to lose a lot of support, particularly in the black community, especially because of what's happening in Georgia.
Well, they're going to lose a lot of elections too.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Let's be honest. This is not, this is, I think it's properly framed as an issue of justice and democracy, but it's also, I mean, there's some
political
self-interest involved in this.
Right.
You're in Georgia. I want you to speak to Georgia in a minute, but I just want to ask you a little more about this. I mean, it seems to me that when he talks about support for a talking filibuster, as opposed to reforming the filibuster in such a way that, like, for special types of legislation, you only need 50 votes, right? I mean, we have that now for the budget. That's the reconciliation process. Mm-hmm. And there was some talk over the past couple of months, like maybe there needs to be a special form of a filibuster as it's applied to voting rights, let's say, or democracy issues, however you want to frame it. And he didn't come out for that. He made it a issue agnostic reformation of the filibuster to make it a talking filibuster. And I still think that, like, we're going to have problems with the $15 minimum wage. I mean, because what I think people don't understand is the filibuster goes away. Let's just say, for all intents and purposes, this is going to give Joe Manchin the opportunity to go and say, like, well, all right, we can get three or four Republican votes. And that's going to give the Joe Manchins and maybe some of those other eight who voted against the $15 minimum wage to come up with like a $12 minimum wage. Right. I mean, but there is no $12. There is no analog for HR1. Talk a little bit about HR1 and talk about Georgia. I know Harris and Biden were meeting with Stacey Abrams either today or yesterday.
Right, right. Actually, I think he's either on his way down here now and had a couple of missteps going up the steps of Air Force One, but that's besides the point. Honestly, HR1 is addressing what Republicans are doing, quite honestly, across the country in key states, Georgia being one of them. They have thrown a full on assault against voting rights here in the state of Georgia. And it includes everything from rolling back the amount of days that people can vote cutting out Sunday voting, which is a direct strike at black voters, particularly with Souls to the Polls, where entire congregations would leave church and go to the polls and vote. They're trying to cut that out. They're trying to get rid of the no excuse voting by mail, which is something that they implemented in order to help them win elections. And when it was used during the pandemic, they're like, OK, we have to get rid of this, all the way to criminalizing being able to give people food and water in lines during while they're waiting to vote. And so it's just piece after piece after piece of legislation. I think some total of 80 pieces of legislation have been going through the state legislature here, and all of them are aimed at curtailing voting rights. And it looks like they're going to pass at least a couple of them and get it signed into law. And without H.R. 1, they're going to be able to get away with this, which honestly, without a tremendous amount of overcompensating through voter registration like they did in the wake of the purge of 2018, in which Brian Kemp helped himself as Secretary of State become governor by suppressing and purging voters. We're going to have an entire pushback like we did after that. I think we registered here over 300,000 people in response to that. Well, in this time, they might have to register 500,000 to 1 million to overcome all of the things that they're trying to do to stop particularly black people from voting here in Georgia.
H.R. 1, incidentally, has a provision specifically saying that you cannot be Secretary of State and have a part in a campaign. So we had in 2000, Catherine Harris was the Secretary of State. She was also the co-chair of the George W. Bush campaign.
I remember that well.
There was a little controversy about that election, you'll recall, in Florida of 2000. In 2004, Ken Blackwell, Secretary of State, there was also in Ohio, where he was Secretary of State in 2004, there was some controversy about a lot of voting booths closed in black neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And Kemp was not the co-chair of his campaign. He was the candidate in this instance and was doing that type of stuff. I mean, this is it's a big deal. And I one of the things also about Georgia was my understanding is that there was a lot of pushback from the business community because you guys have now like a track record of pushing public opinion and forcing these major corporations that are hubbed in, particularly in Atlanta, take a position on this stuff. And they really can't afford to be on the wrong side of these things. And so what the legislature did is they stuffed it in like a big omnibus bill. And so it's like a must pass bill, right? Is that basically what the dynamic is?
That's part of it. And the broad, so the business community is trying to play both sides here. And a lot of love and respect out to Black Voter Matters, Black Voters Matter, that organization, Cliff Albright, who's one of the co-founders there, and Nse Ufad over at the New Georgia Project, because they have actions that have been taking place, like actual boots on the ground here. They staged a series of die-ins where they went to Coca-Cola and protested and laid out on the ground as if they had died in response to Coca-Cola prevaricating, really not being very clear about where they stand on the issue. And the Chamber of Commerce gave a statement, the Georgia State Chamber of Commerce gave a really milquetoast statement trying to say that they support voter rights, but they wouldn't outright condemn the actions that has been taking place, taken by Republicans. And to add to that, you have these organizations that these corporations, rather, that have been donating to the very Republicans who are sponsoring these pieces of legislation. And so they are, we're trying to apply the pressure. There is more pressure to be applied. There is going to be a price to pay. I think these corporations think that they can survive it, to be honest with you, Sam.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's talk about the COVID relief bill. And there's been some sort of like knock on impacts and some, you know, it's one of those things like you don't know what's in it until you pass it type of situations. There were two things that on both ends of it. One, there was no provision to prevent debt collectors from garnishing the $1,400 checks that came in. Now, to be fair, that was, you couldn't do it because of reconciliation. That was even a further stretch, I think, than the $15 minimum wage, which I frankly didn't think was a stretch at all. On the other end of that, at one point, I think maybe you were on when we were talking about this, there were some moderate, so-called moderate Democratic senators who approached Biden about the state and local funding And they wanted to redirect it because they were afraid that supposedly it was going to go to tax cuts in some of these Republican states. And it turns out they got a provision in there that said if a state cuts their taxes, they cannot use the COVID relief money that they get for states and local governments to fill that hole in their budget that they're making because they're cutting taxes. You've got to actually send that money back. And Ohio now is suing the federal government, Republican there, and there's other that are going to do that. Give me your sense overall as we're like now a week out, week and a half out from the signing of that bill. What's your sense of that in terms of like what you anticipated from Joe Biden?
Unnecessary. Well, you know what? I don't want to be too hard, but I want to be sufficiently hard on Joe here because the biggest observation that I have, and I think everybody has had, is the fact that we were negotiating with ourselves, right? And a lot of the red tape that, and a lot of the things that are in the bill, you know, of course, no Republicans signed up for it and none of them voted for it. And so all of the things that are in there is a byproduct of Democratic decisions, right? And that shows you just the extent to which how much power blue dog Democrats, conservative leaning Democrats like Joe Manchin has to have these type of loopholes in there that became a problem after the fact. That said, Sam, I'll be honest with you. I just feel like we're in this place where it's almost like we should be lucky we got anything from this government at this juncture because of how dysfunctional it is. And so many people are actually taking it that way. A lot of people are still disappointed. I'm talking like people on the ground, just listening to people who, you know, I'm sure you have people call into your show and talk about these things and messages. It's like a lot of people are disappointed because the folks aren't getting these checks. There's a lot of people who got checks before who aren't getting checks now because of the means testing that was included in it. But then you have other people who are just ecstatic because they got just enough money to make it to next month, but not enough money to actually survive the rest of this pandemic. And then when you put it in context of the fact that, well, Republicans weren't going to vote for it anyway. So this was an opportunity for us to actually take do something for people to survive this pandemic in a meaningful way. That said, there are other provisions that are in there that are good. The fact that I love the fact that they're touting that this bill is going to reduce child poverty, I think, by some 40%. And then that just speaks even louder to me to say, well, if we could have eradicate child poverty by that much with one piece of legislation, then why in the entire hell haven't we just eradicated it altogether? Right. So it's like they've done some good things, but they didn't do enough. But they have exposed the fact that the federal government actually has a role to play in the suffering of the American people.
But given just how different Biden's tenor is in approaching this relief bill and how different it's been compared to his history as a senator and even a part of the Obama administration, there are a lot of pleasant surprises. I said this on the show the other day. I feel like he's kind of at the 80th percentile of what was possible for Joe Biden in these first few months, right? Because I'm not expecting Bernie Sanders type systemic legislation. That dream was dead when Bernie Sanders lost to Joe Biden. You still push him, and he's shown that he can be pushed, at least on the filibuster and things like that. I'm noticing some tension with leftists who, like, they're almost laboring to find things that, because as Sam likes to say, it's muscle memory, right? The Democratic Party has been so feckless and embarrassing for so many years. And in the past few months, they've actually implemented some important proposals and some things that are going to improve people's lives. And this filibuster reform could change things. So I don't know if you're noticing that dynamic, too. Like, I don't want to give this stimulus bill the most amount of credit possible because there's so many things that could have been done that are better. But I also don't want to do the lazy thing and the easier thing, which is to be cynical, because that doesn't put myself out there and put your ideas out there in any way. And then it disempowers people entirely, because there are a lot of good things that are happening right now.
And let me just add to that. Mm-hmm. It's not just a question about being lazy. It's also a question of, like, how do you navigate this sort of push and pull? Like, I mean, the what you said, Ben, about the 40%, 45% cut in poverty is really it. It's like, that's amazing. And it's also begs the question of, like, wait a second. if we could do 45%, why aren't we doing 95, 98, 100%? Like, it's both those things. And on one hand, you don't want to walk away from the process because you're getting somewhere. Yeah. On the other hand, you don't want to over praise something because you don't want there to be a satisfaction with, like, okay, we're done. Now we just move on to...
You know, I think the answer to that question really is just engage in good faith, right? And I know that's a tall order from some of our former comrades, or I don't know what they consider us these days, but on the left, because it is very easy to just simply attack every single thing that this administration is doing. And they are doing some things that need to be attacked, but we're in this weird space right now where it is far more effective to grow your audience if you're willing to just engage in bad faith and just declare that everyone who is not particularly in your niche, your circle, is like, I mean, they're even saying Nina Turner is a conservative, or AOC is a conservative, and, you know, and all these people are, and I'm like, really, are we, this really where we are? And so what it does, though, it gives you a really simple, over easy analysis of everything. Anything that is done from Joe Biden is going to be bad to one group. And it's funny, like on the right, obviously conservatives, there's literally nothing Joe Biden can do that is going to be meaningful to them. And then we're finding that that paradigm on the far left at this point also. And I don't even know if we should give them the credit of being considered the far left, but I digress. But Emma, you actually pointed out, and I can't really remember the exact policy, but you just tweeted out something to that effect. Speaking of one of the policies that Joe Biden was implementing was just fundamentally good. And you just said it because it is good. I don't know if you remember exactly that tweet, but I think we have to be able.
Do you remember today? If it was today,
it was like it was probably this morning. Probably.
I think I tweeted out that the reaching the 100 million shot threshold in 58 days is objectively good. And then and again, and this is a little myopic, but I do think the left, as you're saying, it's in this bizarre space where they don't know how to take some wins and give some credit because we've been banging our heads against a brick wall for so long with the Democratic Party.
Can I jump in here? Because I'm a little bit on the other end of things, and let me argue that for a second. I put Biden as completely incomplete in terms of migrating him. I think the material policies are good, but you have to look at the structural thing. So $15 got left off, right? Like the PRO Act, we need to see that. If we leave this administration and the PRO Act HR1, like you mentioned, these structural things aren't done, then it's a massive failure for the Democrats. So I think incomplete is where I'm at.
I agree. I wouldn't give him a grade right now either. I'm just saying on those, I'm talking more about the COVID relief bill than anything. And then we'll see how this filibuster is addressed. And then there's the PRO Act. And then there's,
the only thing arguably structural in the COVID relief bill. And it's still, I would say that Matt's correct on this too. It's incomplete, but it is at least the only thing in there that even attempts to be structural is these $300 or $360 payments to families with children. They have already expressed a desire to make that permanent.
Yeah.
Whether they will do that or not is why they've gotten an incomplete, and we're going to need to see when they're done with their homework. But that is the only thing in the bill that is structural in any way. And I think Matt's absolutely right. The PRO Act, HR1 are going to be the only, I would say there's two categories from a structural standpoint, right? One is, are we going to change the structure of the relationship between the government and its people insofar as it providing material, help on an ongoing basis, right? I mean, $300 for every child every month by the government paid to families, we can argue that maybe it should be a little larger, and there's certainly other things like daycare and whatnot, but that is a potentially a structural sort of material benefit. The other thing is, which Democrats never do, and Republicans, just Georgia is a perfect example of it, and how quickly they move, right? Job number one for Republicans in Georgia is, how do we make sure we don't lose the next election the way that we did this past one? Democrats, on day one, and now granted, we had this major need for a COVID relief bill, but the PRO Act and H.R. 1 are both. H.R. 1 in particular is a democracy bill. I mean, it is to make a better democracy. It also helps the Democrats structurally in a couple of different ways. And the PRO Act, same deal. More democracy, allowing labor to have power, ultimately could help the Democrats. I mean, and shape the Democrats, but also help them. And those two are really going to be the big litmus tests on Joe Biden as something other than.
I just want to quickly say this because I think it's getting misinterpreted. I'm not giving Biden a grade. I'm just frustrated by the reflexive negativity about specific already passed things that he's done just because it's easier to do that. And I'm not talking about his legacy or his presidency thus far. I said 80th percentile thus far. He has other things to do. Yeah, and that's going to change.
I personally agree with you, Emma. And I mean, in terms of his legacy, like even if he does everything that we're saying, I still won't look fondly and be like, oh, he was a great president, because just I have that general disposition towards Joe Biden anyway. But I have to overcome that by being fair when he's done a couple of good things. And these are actually, when I say a couple of good things, like those payments per child, like it could be bigger, Sam. But that's huge for families who are like really out here struggling in the middle of this pandemic. Like that can't be under, we can't overstate the impact that that would have. But I think to Emma's point, there is a reflexive left that has more interest in seeing how many ways we can attack every single. I mean, we even have people on the left now attacking the PRO Act. And I'm like, are we serious here? Are we really serious in this regard? And I think it really makes it makes some impact, especially when we talk about the lack of cohesiveness and our ability to organize and to actually push now to collectively as a left push Joe Biden to cancel the student debt. I'm still waiting on that. But if we had more of a solidified, unified left, we could actually organize and do those types of things. And but instead, we're frazzled and we're disjointed. And because a lot of people are still in primary mode, to be honest with you.
Yeah. I mean, I also think that we need to keep a perspective on what constitutes really what's going on with the left and disaggregate that from, you know, what's happening on Twitter.
Social media.
To be honest with you, I mean, I think you know, there are people organizing Medicare for All, reintroduced by Pramila Jayapal this past week. I mean, there's a lot going on the left, and I think it's easy to get, you know, because we live online and that's what we do. And that's where, you know, but there are times where
people are organizing.
No, yeah. it's fair enough in terms of like maybe this perspective, maybe the, you know, reflexiveness that I'm talking about is less, isn't as ubiquitous as I may, you know.
Yeah, I think it's understandable. I mean, this is the world that we work in. And with that said, just to sort of qualify that statement, like, you know, change is often made with, you know, 5%. You get 5% of the people who are pushing very hard on something and you're going to get very close to getting all the way there. I mean, particularly when you're talking specific legislation. I would also add on this $300, I think there's a very good argument that even Mitt Romney's bill was actually better. He had an amendment because he wanted to do it through the Social Security Administration. That's more of a technocratic argument, but I think, they did it through the IRS. We had Elizabeth, I can't remember her last name now from last week, was it? Gosh.
Pancotti.
Arguing that maybe the IRS had more data that allowed it easier. You know, that's a little bit of a weedy argument. But broadly speaking, it is, I think, from the left's perspective, generally, we need to figure out a balance where we are providing, you know, the cookie for good behavior, but also maintaining the stick because I think incomplete is a great way to phrase it because we're not there on some of the really structural things. And it's going to be interesting to see, you know, we're going to be dealing with an infrastructure bill, but they got to get moving. There's a couple other things that are sort of falling through the cracks. Like they're not dealing with the CRA. This is the Congressional Review Act. There's a bunch of Trump actions that were taken in the last 6 months of his presidency that could be reversed by the Democrats, and they seem very slow to do that at this point. Now, let me just get your take on this, and we just got a couple of minutes here, but there are 20 that's forming right now, and they are meeting 10 Democrats, 10 Republicans. The number 10, obviously very important because you need 60 to overcome right. The filibuster as it stands now. This is another one of those sort of everything seems sort of like a microcosm. Is that an indication of how desperate the center is to sort of control the narrative and prevent anything like dramatic from happening? Or is it like we saw in the run up to the COVID relief bill, a necessary pro forma step that needs to be taken to prove to everybody that you're not going to make a deal with these 10 Republicans. You're not going to bring them along. I mean, Schumer coming out and hammering Susan Collins the other day. I wonder what was behind that, because let's put it this way. If Chuck Schumer is saying to his caucus, Susan Collins, the poster child for striking the gang of whatever number it is deal, is not an honest broker. Are you going to trust, I don't know, Barrasso, like numbers 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 of that coalition? No way. Right. I mean, right. But we're not going to know until this thing plays out.
Yeah, no, actually, that's a great observation, Sam. I think it's probably both. Right. I can't hold my breath on them actually playing smart politics, but you got to expose them. And I feel like this does give them an opportunity to say that we tried. But the real question is after they try, because let me start here. I feel like it's a fool's errand to even try with Republicans when they have already shown the track record that is necessary to prove that you're not going to get 10 of them to vote on anything meaningful for the American people. So why waste your time? That's my starting position. They're obviously dealing with some different calculus. I don't agree with their laws of physics that they're dealing with in the Democratic Party, but they feel like they have to go through this. The real question is, on the other side of this, are they going to do what they have to do, or are they just using this as a way to stall necessary movement on reforming or abolishing the filibuster? And I think from your first, the way you framed it at first is perhaps they are really hammering into the minds of those 10 Republicans. Like, listen, this time around, we can't protect you. We can't protect you from the filibuster. It's going to be gone if you don't do X, Y, and Z. The thing is in those negotiations, what we're going to see is that those 10 Democrats that are teaming up with those 10 Republicans, those 10 Democrats are going to move closer to those Republicans. And then they're going to try to convince the other Democrats that they have some type of bipartisanship. That's my gut instinct. I hope I'm wrong. But again, Democrats play by a different set of calculus than we do.
Well, that's the thing. It could go either way, because it could also be that those 10 Democrats, and maybe we're talking about 4 or 5 in the middle there, they look across the table and the argument that they can make a deal, they realize like we can't. Yeah. And so this is the way that some of those Democrats are going to be convinced like it's filibuster reform time, because look, Susan Collins, we can't even trust. There's 9. And of those other 9, like, are you really telling me like number 7, 8, 9, 10?
Yeah.
They're not going to vote for anything that Joe Biden's going to propose. And then here's the last question. So Mitch McConnell comes out last week or this week, I guess, and yeah. says, if you get rid of the filibuster, I'm going to
scorch earth.
I'm scorched earth.
Yeah.
What could that possibly mean? That is any different from the earth that he scorched
Thank
before.
You.
And you factor in the fact that he has been trying to get the Kentucky state legislature to change the way that they replace a senator who retires. Are we going to be talking about Mitch McConnell 3 months from now?
Well, actually, I didn't think you were going to go there with that question. I'm not sure as far as Mitch McConnell, but it is time up for, and I think he understands that about his own political career. But the thing is that he's really, it seemed like it reeked of desperation. it reeked of desperation in the sense that he's like, I have to, let's just scare everybody with what we're going to do if we get rid of the filibuster. And the truth of the matter is like, you're right. They have engaged in scorched earth politics with Democrats for 40 years, and Democrats are just catching on. So good on Republicans for being that effective, right? But at the end of the day, it's like, what more are they going to do? Because these are their goals. And I think what Democrats need to look at this as is not as a threat, and the American people should not look at this as a threat, but look at this as a list of goals that they want to do and they are going to do if they ever get back in power, which makes HR 1 so important because they're doing everything that they can to ensure that they can have a hegemony on power in this country, even if they are in the minority. So if I think Democrats' number one move at this point is to replay that clip as an ad every single day across the country and let the American people know that they're going to attack workers' rights with, he promised, a right to work, you know, his muffled voice, right to work. He promised an attack on women's rights to choose over their bodies. He attacked everything that he listed there is really a repugnant list of policies that they stand on, but they've never actually just said it in one complete sentence because they knew how toxic it was. And he thought that he could scare us. But if Democrats were smart, they would take that to every single state and let Americans know this is what Republicans are going to do when they ever get back in power.
Yeah, in their own words. Very well said, Ben Dixon. Folks can check out the Benjamin Dixon Show on YouTube and like it or not in the morning.
Yep. On the same YouTube channel, the Benjamin Dixon Show channel.
All right. Ben Dixon, always, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Ben.
Pleasure's ours. Take care, everybody. Take care, everyone.
All right, folks. Going to take a quick break. Be right back to dock this thing at the end of the week. So one other note I wanted to talk about with HR 1, because I think, you know, Emma and I, we have both talked about this, and I certainly have implied it because I misunderstood something about it. There is a provision in HR 1 that will have the federal government call for independent commissions to deal with redistricting. And anybody who's been listening to this program long enough and in carefully enough knows that we have talked about the Supreme Court is, as presently constituted, would probably find that state legislatures cannot delegate the authority to redistrict to an independent commission. But I spoke to Lawrence Lessig for actually a second hour of this program that I'm doing on Peacock, the Choice Channel. And we're going to run that interview soon, but we're doing it every day at 5 p.m., a couple more interviews. Lawrence Lessig told me that those are two different things. When the federal government says it, it is on very, very solid constitutional ground. Whereas if the state legislature issues it, this is, of course, only for federal elections. So I just wanted to put that out there because I know that you and I have talked about that a little bit in the past, that the Supreme Court could overturn that. And that's not the case, or they could do whatever they want, but a much harder hill for them to climb. That's all for us, Emma. You don't seem to be very bothered by that. It's Friday.
Well, are we out?
And we will see you guys on Monday.
Oh, yeah. I thought that was it.
And for those of you sticking around, we're still here. I was waiting for you to say goodbye.
What were you even teeing me up to say?
I was teeing you up to say bye, see you Monday, or happy Friday.
Have a nice weekend.
Have a nice weekend.
Yeah, well, I don't care about our viewers' weekends.
Yeah, there you go.
That's not true.
That's right. That's classic. Sorry. Classic. Viglin doesn't, she doesn't even, you don't even believe in the weekends, do you? Emma comes into the office during Saturday and Sunday, does the whole show for without even the cameras.
I do it for the love of the game.
All right. Let's bring on our next guest, shall we? Paul Blest. He is apparently the co-owner, staff writer at the Discourse blog. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And kudos to you, co-owner. You don't even give yourself like executive staff writer. Just go on with the full-on.
No, we're all sort of equal partners in this. And yeah, we have an editor, Jack Merkinson, but yeah, the rest of us just go by staff writer.
All right. Well, I appreciate that. That's yeah. Good stuff.
We're very egalitarian.
I would call myself executive CEO of all things.
I should just start doing that.
That's Emma's title on this show, actually.
Yeah, I make more than Sam.
She's the executive CEO here. All right, so Paul,
two executives.
Let's talk about this. I just saw this break this morning, and I know that you've written you wrote a piece about Marjorie Taylor Greene. I don't know if it was a couple of weeks ago. I have no idea.
Right.
Last week or she just got banned from Twitter. Is that right? Did I see that?
Yeah, I saw that briefly this morning.
Just now?
I think like in the past 20.
It was like a suspension, like a 12 hour thing at least.
That's put in the corner. But give us your argument about Marjorie Taylor Greene, who she represents in the context of what Democrats need to do with the Republicans.
I mean, I think that she represents sort of this growing constituency within the Republican Party that, you know, beyond Trump, this is what the future is going to look like. It's going to look like people like Marjorie Taylor Greene. It's going to look like people like Madison Cawthorn, who lives in North Carolina, as do I. Somebody like her is, you know, she's sort of the sort of lightning rod because of the QAnon stuff, but you know, this is somebody that's going to have a following in the Republican Party for a long time. And you know, she, you know, beyond the conspiracy theories, you know, it's just sort of the, you know, visceral reactionary politics that, you know, I think is going to sort of direct the future.
And I mean, have they not been there already?
Yeah, I mean, this is what they've been building up to. I think that she just sort of puts it in plain terms. You know, it's sort of the, you know, there was a Slate piece a couple of days ago about how these are just sort of like the neighborhood cranks of in the Republican Party now. You know, the freshman class, particularly the Lauren Boberts, the Cawthorns, the Marjorie Taylor Greens. You know, these are just sort of the like, you know, Facebook commenters on your local newspaper's website, you know, about, you know, when just like blaming everything on Black Lives Matter. Antifa is like coming to our town to like burn down the Denny's. And like, you know, this is her entire thing. And, you know, Trump showed that there's a very, very large constituency for that within the party. And she's just sort of, you know, taking it to that next level of crankery.
Well, I mean, I would agree that their level of crankery is indicative of those, you know, the people right into your local newspaper. But the difference is that these are the editors of the paper.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, like, I think like the analogy breaks down in terms of their power within the Republican Party. I mean, I've watched this now for almost, you know, close to 20 years.
Right.
I mean, like professionally that there is a one way. So far, at one point, I guess it changes, but there has been like a one-way trajectory, and that is the crazy people move to the center of the party. Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, Pat Toomey, right? I mean,
right, yeah.
Pat Toomey in 2004, when Pat Toomey was being pushed by the Club for Growth, and they were primarying Arlen Specter. Pat Toomey was the lunatic in that race.
Yeah.
And there's, I mean, no one would say that Pat Toomey is on the fringe of the Republican Party now. I mean, he's considered like one of the normal ones at this point.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you were just talking to Ben about, you know, the Gang of 20. And I was looking at the names on this list, and Tom Tillis is on this list. Like, Tom Tillis is responsible for like kicking off the Tea Party revolution in North Carolina. I mean, all the most horrible things you've seen in North Carolina over the last 10 years were either enacted because of Tom Tillis or were put into motion by Tom Tillis. And this is now considered somebody who's like one of the reasonable Republicans to work with. And yeah, it's, I think you're exactly right about that. I mean, you know, somebody like Toomey or somebody like Tillis is, has really, you know, gain this constituency because the party is moving so far to the right. You know, even saying one time, even frowning once at Trump is enough to sort of get you the label of moderate in Politico.
True. It's fascinating. Who else is on that list? Do you have that list handy? Because I mean, what that tells me about Tillis is that he's worried about something that's happening in North Carolina, right? I mean,
right.
Like to get into this group of 20, is your branding exercise. Like because nobody thinks that there's going to be a single piece of legislation. I mean, there may be like a post office somewhere named, but thinks there's going to be a single piece of legislation that's going to pass in the Senate 60 votes to 40. It's just, there's not going to happen.
Yeah.
And so if you're Tom Tillis, you're there because you want to project that you are somewhat reasonable to the people in North Carolina. And it's really just a branding exercise. But Tom Tillis is never going to be able to go that far, or he's going to get primaried.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there was like a, you know, there was a lot of talk last year that he was going to get primaried by somebody like Mark Walker or Mark Meadows. And Walker's running for Senate for Burr's seat now in 2022. And yeah, I'm just looking at the list and, you know, Romney's on the list, Susan Collins, Murkowski, but also, you know, Jerry Moran from Kansas, like somebody who's always been, you know, on the right wing of the Republican Party and now sort of considered, you know, this sort of reasonable guy to work with. Right. But yeah, I think you're right. He's going to get primaried if he moves too far to the center. I mean, he almost did. And, you know, North Carolina, I think, is a little bit behind a place like Arizona and Georgia. You know, 2008, when Obama won this state, was a fluke, kind of. You know, everything was sort of, it was like just sort of like a perfect storm to flip the state to the Democrats. But, you know, I think that by 2024, you know, the fact that, you know, the state's urban areas like Raleigh and Charlotte and Durham are really growing, you know, this could be a problem for Tillis in 4 years. You know, the fact that, you know, if he tries to move too far to the right. So, you know, this is sort of a low stakes thing to give him the conservative bona fides that you know, he needs to run for office or, you know, run for re-election.
What's going on with Moral Mondays? I mean, I would have imagined 4 or 5 years ago that Moral Mondays would have turned into the force that flipped Georgia in North Carolina.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good point. And I think that, you know, the Moral Mondays and you know, the NAACP and Reverend Barber, you know, I think they laid the groundwork and it just sort of hasn't happened yet, but I, you know, he stepped down and you know, is working with the Poor People's Campaign now, and it's sort of more national. But yeah, as far as I know, you know, the Moral Mondays aren't happening anymore. There's you know, a rally every February in North Carolina. But, you know, ever since, I think the last one that really drove a lot of people out was 2017, right after Trump got inaugurated.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Also, let's talk about Marco Rubio. I really appreciated your piece because people forget what a weasel this guy has been.
Mm-hmm.
For like from the moment, I mean, I remember the whole immigration thing very, very, very clearly, actually.
Right.
Just because of a friend who is a commentator who actually sort of thought that Rubio was sincere. But talk to us about Rubio and his sort of sleight of hand with this whole Amazon thing where he, you know, there's a game that's being played by the Rubios and I think the Hollies on some level. Talk about that game where Rubio sort of came out in support of the Bessemer strike.
Right.
I should say unionization rather.
Yeah. So Rubio came out with this op-ed last Friday, I believe it was, in USA Today, where he said that he supports the unionization effort in Bessemer, Alabama, and Amazon. But his argument, you know, it's kind of funny, the trajectory that this took, because it leaked on Axios, I think it was, earlier that morning. Oh, Rubio is coming out in favor of unionization. And then that op-ed dropped, that it was basically like, you know, we need to unionize against the wokes is like what his argument was. that was the whole thing. You know, there's Amazon is like pushing this like woke ideology, basically like critical race theory, on its workers. And like, that's something that he'll support unionization for. You know, he made it very clear that he doesn't support the PRO Act. He made it very clear, even says in the op-ed, that he thinks an antagonistic relationship between management and labor is a bad thing. But, you know, when it comes to just like scoring points against Amazon, this is something that he's willing to support. And I think it sort of more broadly reflects, you know, because, you know, I make the argument in the piece, but Rubio is sort of a bellwether for the Republican Party and like the hot new grift that they pick up every couple of years. You know, it was moving to the center after the Republican autopsy in 2012, where they said, you know, we need to, you know, reach out to a more diverse group of voters. And, you know, he supported the immigration reform thing. You know, he was sort of like a chummy, like Florida House speaker, and then ran as a Tea Party guy. And now he's doing the Josh Hawley thing, where he's like, we need more like working class voters. We need to like make that our base. And like the corporations they're just like anti-conservative and all this other stuff. And it's, you know, patently not true. But what is true is that, you know, in recent years, and, you know, this happened after HB2 in North Carolina, and it happened during the Trump years, you know, a lot of corporations were fine with what Republicans were passing when it came to like the 2017 tax cut. But they sort of publicly distanced themselves because they were catching so much stuff from, you know, the left and even, you know, liberals about, you know, supporting them through PAC money and stuff like that. So they basically, Rubio is basically giving them an ultimatum, I think, with that op-ed. And he's saying, you know, you need to come back over and publicly, you know, align with us, or else you're not going to have any friends. You know, there's the Democrats just passed the PRO Act in the House for the second time. You know, who knows what kind of chance it has in the Senate so far. But, you know, I think that, you know, the argument that I make in the piece is that, you know, corporations have always sort of been uneasy with this like social justice role that they've been given. And, you know, I think that if they're going to lose the labor fights too, I think they would rather just throw in with somebody like Marco Rubio in the Republican Party.
Well, that's what I'm immensely curious about, because, you know, Democrats have always been hypocritical on the issue of political contributions and corruption, really in terms of big tech and that cozy relationship that's lasted for years between companies like Facebook and Google and Amazon with the Democratic Party. And there is a shift there. I mean, that's why the PRO Act is so notable. So are you noticing a broader realignment of tech companies with the Republican Party, with the more respectable Republicans, as they begin to transition away from Trump? And also it's just fascinating to see Republicans kind of co-opt energy on the left in the way Tucker Carlson's kind of doing this eco-fascism thing too, right? And yeah, use it for their own ends. That's a secondary question, but really just wondering what you think of that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that the alignment or the realignment is happening yet so far. I think that it's still early, and like Trump is still like, you know, not even a distant memory. You know, he's still like tweeting out press releases, basically. I think that if the labor fight in Amazon is successful, and like, you know, these places start unionizing more, and this becomes, you know, sort of the next ground for labor organizing, and we're able to like break through to at these tech companies, which I think is, you know, starting to become a real possibility. I think it could change. I think that, you know, if the Republicans, you know, if they go, in that direction where they, you know, try to sort of give this ultimatum to these companies and say, you know, you're not going to have any support. You know, there's going to be, we're both going to come after the Democrats and the Republicans are both going to come after you on monopolies, on labor and stuff like that. You know, I think you could see an alignment, you know, maybe not with the Josh Hawleys, but, you know, with the mainstream Republican Party, because, I mean, let's face it, like at this point, Josh Hawley is sort of an outlier in the Republican Party just by even talking about this stuff. But Rubio, I think, senses that this is the way that things are going.
I just find it fascinating that he's like attacking Amazon for being woke.
Yeah.
When I think of Amazon, I think they're woke. I think they're really connected with, right? Like, it's just, that's not even the right company to attack. It's like, you could go after Nike, I guess.
Well, they're not selling the used Dr. Seuss books. So,
I guess
they have anti-discrimination policies that they post on their wall in their factories. Like, I mean, what is the wokeism that
as their workers are peeing in water bottles because they can't take breaks?
Yeah, right next to the don't organizing union sign, there's a, you know, there's a racial bias training later today. I mean, there's like, you know, the even Amazon, you know, there's sort of like this very performative thing right after the George Floyd killing happened, you know, and the protests started, and they, you know, workers at Whole Foods around the country, and Amazon owns Whole Foods. They were started to wear Black Lives Matter pins and Black Lives Matter shirts, and Whole Foods as a company basically shut that down. They started sending workers home. There's a lawsuit about that was filed in Massachusetts, where workers were basically going on strikes, because they weren't allowed to wear Black Lives Matter pins. So like, even this argument that they're woke is just completely false. You know, they don't actually like care about social justice in a real way because they don't care about economic justice. And those things are inextricably linked, I think.
But it does really seem curious that Rubio sees that it is him trying to sort of like, not so much a blocking play, but he wants to be when we look at that field in 2024 on the stage, he wants to be in the Hawley quadrant, but he's going to have to in some way distinguish himself from Hawley, but he wants to be on that. I'm the pro worker guy. I came out in favor of the Bessemer strike. And then how much he hits that asterisk because Amazon is woke it will depend on, I think, the moment there. I think he just sees it as some type of flexibility.
Well, let me just add, Sam, quickly, like it's the same triangulation that someone like Tucker Carlson is doing, right, where they're co-opting populist rhetoric and then you just like unveil all of the same politics beneath it. And I think that's the new era of how conservative or whatever paleo conservatism is. I'm not entirely sure about the definition, but that's how they're all trying to posture now, like Hawley and them.
I think that's true. I think like Hawley and Tucker Carlson in particular have they're a little bit more sincere in their project. I mean, I get the sense that Rubio is just like, I'm going to be able to deploy this if I need to.
Yes.
I think Tucker Carlson is making like he is really pushing like this, you know, Strasserite type of argument that, you know, that is really founded on a white nationalism that corporations are evil because they're inhibiting our nationalism on some level.
Do you think that he's sort of, you know, do you think he's moved? Because I remember, you know, a couple of years ago, that video resurfaced of him doing this book thing where he makes fun of Bill O'Reilly's faux populism. This is like in 2002 or 2003. So do you think that he's like actually moved to the right, or is this just part of a TV character that he's playing? I mean, both are horrible, but
I don't know what's more horrible, and I can't even answer.
Exactly.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's a guess. I think it's a little bit of both.
Yeah.
I think it's a little bit.
Doesn't
of both.
Even matter.
I mean, I can tell you for a fact that during the Iraq War, he was in the back. He would walk off that Crossfire set, go have a cigarette in the back and just be like, I don't give a shit about this.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think like you can go, I mean, tracking Tucker Carlson would also be good too. Cause I don't know if you remember how he launched the Daily Caller. He got up in front of CPAC and said, the problem with us, and this is maybe 10 years ago now. I don't remember exactly when it was.
Mm.
The problem with us talking to conservatives, that we don't do real reporting. He chastised CPAC for not having any real journalists. And then he launches a Daily Caller and he gave that a try for 6 months and realized like, oh, conservatives don't want real reporting. And then it was like all about like Swedish models and then just morphed into like, oh, wait, we can harass like Democratic women. And then we've like achieved both of our key demo desires, basically. I think he is about as cynical as they can get.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you can see it. Like, look, you look at like he's bringing Michael Tracy on. His whole shtick is to sort of like piss off the libs. And I don't think it's working in terms of his ratings. I mean, because frankly, like, I think his sort of conservative audience is like, wait, who? I mean, I don't know. Maybe he's like trying to build like a little, you know, online army that is coming from these people, which is possible. But I just don't think there's enough of them to, you know, to support his program. I guess they could tune in, but I think it's pretty. I think it's pretty.
I think it brings in a little bit of a younger flavor. Like, I think it to what Fox is doing. I doubt it's like reflected in their nightly TV viewership, but in terms of maybe what's circulated online. What he's doing resonates a lot more with young, you know, angry male conservatives than what anything Hannity or Laura Ingraham's doing.
I think that's true. It keeps him hip, as it were. Paul, what's your take on where are you grading Joe Biden today based upon your expectations? I mean, you heard some of the conversation we had with Benjamin.
All right. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's slightly better than I expected. I didn't expect them to just bull right through with the relief bill. They're sort of getting a lot of credit for the $1.9 trillion relief bill, but you know, a lot of people forget that the House passed like a $3.3 trillion relief bill last year. So like, they could have gone a little bit bigger, but you know. All things considered, you know, it was more than twice the size of the recovery package back in 2009. And I think that they learned a lot about that. You know, a lot of these people are Obama appointees from that time. You know, but the minimum wage thing, you know, I think that a lot of that falls on Biden. You know, obviously Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin voted against it, but also, you know, Chris Coons and Tom Carper, you know, both senators from Delaware, both people who have in the past, at least Tom Carper, you know, ran on raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour.
Coons has come out since and said, I'm for the $15 minimum wage, but there's two provisions that he hasn't articulated what they are.
And what provisions? No follow up there. Yeah.
The two.
Right. Exactly.
The two provisions.
Yeah. I mean, it's so easy to say after you've already voted it down, you know, I actually support this, just not in the way that it's happening. I mean, you know, with a 50, you know, they're always talking about like purity tests, you know, on the left. And this is like the biggest purity test of all. You know, if the goal is to raise it to a $15 minimum wage, then that achieves the goal. Like what else is there?
Right. My response to Chris Coons would be like, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. You want a $15 minimum wage.
Yeah.
You know, lay off those two provisions. I understand you can't get those two provisions. Those two provisions are like, there's two of them and they're both provisions, but you can get past that.
The Chris Bros are just going crazy over this.
Yeah. The Coonheads.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I think it was Matt that said this. I think incomplete is the you know, what I would use. You know, I haven't really seen enough yet. You know, the border rhetoric that he's sort of espousing so far, it's not great. You know, there's, I think a lot of people are very understandably frustrated by that, you know, especially immigration advocates. And, you know, it's just one of those things that like, I very much hope that this doesn't fall by the wayside, but you know, you're already seeing it sort of like in the liberal circles of Twitter where it's just like, oh, well, this isn't exactly like the cages. Like, you know, this is a different thing altogether. And you know, it's, it's just sort of, you know, it's indicative of this entire, you know, broken immigration system, you know, and it's obviously doesn't fall all on Biden, but, you know, there hasn't been a concerted effort. You know, we talk a lot about the Voting Rights Bill and the PRO Act, and you know, obviously those are priorities when it comes to the filibuster. Nobody's really talking about the immigration bill that they introduced as something that can pass with the filibuster. And, you know, I think that it just seems like so far it's lip service to me.
I think the fact that they passed that path for citizenship for Dreamers and for temporary protected status folks is indicative as a standalone bill. I think is indicative of like they realize we're not going whole hog on this. We're just not going
to absolutely
comprehensive immigration reform. We're just going to try and get citizenship for DACA. Maybe they'll go for DAPA if they get DACA and the TPS. And then it's really just up to Biden trying to piece together a system from an executive as executive action. I mean, one of the things that I guess is contributing to, I mean, obviously every year at this time, when the weather starts to break, there's more folks who come up, but apparently the Biden administration rolled back a rule that was imposed by the Trump administration that dealing with COVID, basically barring immigrants who are at the Mexican border from coming in because of COVID. But they rolled it back for children. And so I don't know if this is the case, but I've been reading a little bit, but that apparently a lot of parents are sending their children through because the children can get through and the parents cannot. And they're living in a dangerous and difficult situation at the border. They let their kids through. I don't know why we can't just expedite, you know, depreciate the number of people over the course of the next, you know, 12, 16 months. You're going to have an extended stay with your relatives. Go. I don't know. I mean, it just seems ridiculous to me.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, there's obviously, you know, it seems like they're taking this political consideration because this is becoming the thing for the right. And I don't think it's going to stop anytime soon, you know, talking about the border crisis, because they realize at this point, you know, the attacks on Biden aren't sticking like they did to Obama. They don't stick like they did.
Why do you think
Nancy Pelosi? Yeah, exactly. It's very obvious why, but you know, they really tried with the laptop stuff and the Hunter Biden stuff and nobody cared. So now they're coming, you know, they're going to go full on, you know, to this like border crisis thing and like, see, Trump was right on the border. And it's, you know, it's very cynical, but you know, I think this is going to be the major thing that they talk about in 2022, you know, especially as we get a little bit farther from the relief package.
But the problem they're going to have with that, well, there's two things that raises. One is I think they're going to have a real problem with that because they don't have the mechanism, it seems to me, to create the sense of crisis that they want to in terms of like that to really make this sell. I mean, if you're trying to convince people in Minnesota that their lake homes are in danger from a caravan, you really need like the president of the United States to be saying stuff like that. Like, right. Like it's like, I'm sorry that you're just not going to get the same movement. I think, right. I just don't think that you can create that same sense. And then the other thing it raises is like, how effed up is this country that, it's so clear that like, because Joe Biden is a white guy and maybe like an old white guy, that he is immune from like the things that would clearly be hobbling him if he was a she or if he was, you know, black or Latino.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the fact that this is, and I think it, you know, I think that it's like 90% of it. And I think 10% is that, you know, Biden, even if he's sort of co-signing, you know, more spending and just sort of a more left position than he's ever had, just like, you know, by signing the bill and by supporting it, you know, he still has that like rhetoric thing where he just like, you know, is still talking like he's in the 90s in a lot of ways, you know, we need more bipartisanship and all this other stuff. And I think that like, that's really, you know, this is something that I got obviously mad about, you know, for 2 years during the primary and then the general election. But you know, it seems to be having an effect where it's like disarming, you know, the right in a way that I didn't expect to happen. You know, I thought they would find a way, and so far they haven't found a way, but you know, I think that's exactly right.
Do you think
exactly
President
right.
Bernie Sanders could have gotten this COVID relief bill passed with this?
That's a really good question. You know, I think that he's, you know, I think that Manchin and Sinema would have been tougher sells. You know, and I think Bernie might have gone bigger. You know, and it also depends on the way that, like, Bernie would have used the bully pulpit and, you know, coming after. I think one of the smartest things Biden did was send Kamala Harris to to Arizona and West Virginia to do these interviews.
And it shows they could have done that for the $15 minimum wage, but chose not to. But I digress.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's the infuriating thing. And that's why I sort of pin it more on Biden than Sinema and Manchin and even the six Democratic senators, because, you know, Biden was telling governors in you know, I think Politico reported this a couple of weeks before the vote even happened, you know, the $15 minimum wage is going to happen, so don't worry about it. I think that sent a huge sign to, and he was even telling senators this, and like, you know, if he tells you to get on board with something, it gives you, he's the president, you know, they're going to want to deliver wins for their president because their success in 2022 and beyond is tied to his success.
That was why, you know, the eight senators that voted against it was artificially to protect Biden, the $15 minimum wage as a standalone bill. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like, it's, you know, this could have been, they could have overruled the Senate parliamentarian. You know, they could have gone harder after this, but they just didn't. And I think that, you know, that's on the White House. I think that, you know, if they really wanted a $15 minimum wage, this was the time to do it. You know, now they could go after a standalone bill. And if the filibuster gets, you know, killed over voting rights or the PRO Act, you know, I think that opens up a lot of possibilities. But, you know, I'm not the most optimistic that they're going to get over the finish line when it comes to this. But I mean, I think they also need to understand that, you know, the $15 minimum wage is more popular than any of them. You know, especially in a place like Florida, where a $15 minimum wage passed by 22, 23 points and Biden ended up losing by 3 or 4 points. So I think that, you know, doing a $15 minimum wage, you know, within the next 2 years, that's something they need to run on in 2022 if they want to, you know, keep the House majority and expand the Senate majority beyond, you know, Kamala Harris, you know, having the tie-breaking vote.
I agree. Paul, real pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, folks, Paul. Can check out, they can go to
discourseblog.com/subscribe. And we're having a sale on Tuesday. So
Tuesday sale.
Uh-huh. Yep.
So folks, head over to the Discourse blog on Tuesday. Check it out. You can read a little bit of it, right?
This week we took down the paywall. So yeah, you don't have to wait until Tuesday to read it, but yeah, smart. You can check it out.
All right, folks. Thank you, Paul. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Folks, we're going to head into the fun half of the program, wherein we will take your phone calls. We will read your IMs and we will do that. We'll be right back. This is a cue for music. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. you're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
Dude.
You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.